Hey, everybody, it's Barry from the What Podcast.
Hey, it's Russ.
Hey, it's Brian, and we are giving away two tickets to Bonnaroo 2024. These are GA Plus, and they include camping. Russ, how do people get qualified?
We want to hear your top artists to play on the Bonnaroo 2024 lineup.
Call 423-667-7877 and tell us who we should check out. It's the What Podcast. Thanks.
Hi, this is James Mercer from The Shins.
This is Shirley Manson.
This is Lotte Holst, co-founder of The Cure.
This is Huey Lewis giving you the story behind the song.
The story behind the song is back with an exciting second season. We peel back the layers on music's most iconic hits with legendary artists like The Killers, Heart, The B-52s, Violent Femmes, Jewel, Huey Lewis, Modern English, and more. To keep the music flowing, we'll be sprinkling in classic episodes from our archives between each new one. So check out The Story Behind the Song wherever you get your podcast.
Consequence Podcast Network.
There was a good chance we would never hear from Grace Potter again. Grace Potter and the Nocturnals broke up a few years ago. Her marriage dissolved, and isolation she went. 4 years later, the music started exploding from her, which now has resulted in a new album, a new tour, a new marriage, and a whole new outlook on her life. Grace Potter is our guest this week on the What Podcast. It starts right now. You're always trying to do your best. The What Podcast, which bands this year that matter. I'm Brad Steiner, that's Barry Corder, along with Lord Taco. A little on location today, Mr. Barry Corder. I found myself in Austin, Texas, and I'm really smart. I'm doing this outside in the middle of the day in Texas heat.
Are you doing it just because you're jealous of the whole Mike Daly? I mean, I know he had the best background, and you commented on it. Is that what this is about?
I am. I'm traversing the country trying to find to one up Mike Daly's background. Yes, I could have just used a green screen, but no, damn it, I am looking for my own best Mike Daly background. I was in Austin doing a event with the Black Pumas, and you know, this band is just one of those stories where they just come out of nowhere in maybe one of the hardest years to ever break a band. And they've sold out 5 nights at Stubbs. They're selling out 3 nights at Brooklyn Steel. This thing has just exploded for this band. And now you're finding them on, you know, festival lineup after festival lineup. It's pretty remarkable to see. And by the way, one of the strangest feelings I've ever had, standing amongst a sold out crowd at Stubbs with sweating people.
Yeah, tell me about that.
Sweating and cheering, and it was just odd, you know?
Well, that's why I'm asking that, because that's what we're heading into, and I haven't done it yet. That's an interesting perspective.
Yeah, I don't know if it really hit me. It felt so natural and so normal that I didn't even realize it was weird until about midway through, when a girl like shoved her way in front of me. And then I said, oh my God, somebody touched me. Oh my God, I've just been touched. And like, I don't know. I think it was odd in the way that it felt so normal. Yeah. If that makes sense.
Yeah. That's why I'm asking. It's going to be interesting. I've had my shots, and I've been in environments where, you know, you don't think about it. And then you see one person or several in a mask and you remember, oh, hey, you know, this isn't over. This thing is still happening. So,
yeah, you know, it was, I guess what I'm trying to say is that it's weird that I didn't even notice.
Yeah.
I think that's what, you know, it's more than just being normal. It's that I didn't even consider it.
Yeah. Well, you know, you spent a whole lot of your life not living this way.
Yeah.
That's why I'm asking. I've it's going to be curious how we, how, because of shows and festivals and everything like that, I'm very curious to see how it acts.
You, I had a,
you can't, it, it's kind of like an all in or not thing. It's the old, like, I mean, I've used the analogy so many times. It's like having a peeing section in a swimming pool. You know, it's still funny.
I mean, it, no, it's, it is true. I mean, the family afterwards, and not just the family, but some people on the Instagram after they saw the video of the crowd, you know, hit us up and was, you know, they were pretty perturbed and irritated, you know, that, you know, we would put ourselves in such, you know, such a situation like that, that was so dangerous. But, you know, my theory on this, and I don't know if I'm right. I don't even know if I'm the majority. I don't, I guess I don't really care, but at some point we got to rip the Band-Aid off here, right, and give some of these things a try, or else, you know, we're going to be stuck, you know, living in fear forever.
That's right.
You know, and at some point we've got to at least give it a go. We've got to at least try.
I agree. And I think you and I are both in that same boat where early on it was like, stay home, be safe, wear a mask. And now it's, you know, we got to do it.
Yeah, I mean, and, you know, we've done everything that we can do. We've gotten the shots. I liked mine so much. I got all three vaccines. I did all the masking. But at this point, I don't even carry a mask with me anymore. I know that's, you know, not, I mean, the wife does, but I have forgotten a mask probably every day for the last week and a half.
It's interesting. I debated whether I had an interview, a couple of interviews the other day, and left it in the house and thought, I'm just going to go take it because I don't want to put them in that spot.
Yeah, I know. I mean,
if I walked in and they were all masked up, then I needed a mask.
Well, it's weird going to a restaurant where they say masks are required until you sit down and nobody on the staff is wearing a mask.
Right.
You know, that bad boy is coming off. I am not bothering with your dumb rules when you don't even follow them.
So far for me, it's the other way. I walk in and all the staff has their mask. Of course, half of them have it, you know, below the nose. So it's
right. I'm also in Texas, though. Let's just remember I'm in Texas.
Fair point.
Yeah, the rules are a tad different here. You know, the other thing about the show, there was such an interesting conversation I had with Eric and Adrian from Black Pumas. They said before the show that the moment they hit the first note, they were going to be really, really emotional. And he was going to probably break down and cry the minute that he hit the first note on his guitar. That sort of sent chills down my spine. And watching that happen, you could, I mean, it doesn't feel freeing exactly because there's still some trepidation there, but I think the emotional toll is something I hadn't necessarily considered, you know, how they're going to process what they're doing, right? More than just, hey, this is going to be fun. Hey, this is going to be good. I'm really excited to do this. This is going to be sort of like an emotional moment for a lot of these bands. And, you know, I don't know many other artists outside of country music that are like the Black Pumas that are doing so many shows so early, all sold out.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I haven't looked at those numbers or anything, but I'm not surprised to hear him, you know, plan to be emotional.
Yeah.
Only because I've talked to so many artists for this whole year. I say so many, far fewer than before. And this sounds so trite and simple, but they're people like everybody else. They've been, and we're going to talk to one here in a minute. You know, they thought it was going to be one thing and it ended up being another. And just like everybody else, whether they're a restaurant owner or a business, I mean, a tire salesman or whatever, they all have said the same thing. We found out what's really important. And it means different. That means different things for different people. It could be, you know, time with a child, time with an older family. Mm-hmm. It could be the business. It could be whatever. But the point is they found out what's really important. So,
well, yeah,
I know what you mean and it's touching, but it's not surprising.
Yeah. The other thing. Yeah, go ahead. Sorry.
I was just one more thing is that's the other thing that's become the reality of this last year is it's everybody. And I don't think we've really talked. I don't think a lot of people have talked about it. It's not just, you know, Barry in Chattanooga or Brad in New Orleans who've gone through this horrible thing. It's everybody all over the world.
Yeah.
So there's kind of this I don't know what it is yet. I haven't put a point on that one.
It's a collective experience that we don't necessarily have very often. You know, there's very few moments throughout the year where we're all doing the same thing at the same time. It's like the Super Bowl and COVID.
Exactly.
That's pretty much all. By the way, the other big piece of news from my trip in Austin is Barry. Last night, I wore a hat.
Did you lose a bet?
No, the kind people, the manager of Black Pumas was nice enough to give me the commemorative five nights sold out Stubbs Black Pumas hat. And you know what? I think that I pulled it off.
You don't have it with you. We're not going to be.
You know
able
what?
To see it.
Not doing that. No, I am not. I don't feel that comfortable.
Is it like a 10-gallon hat or is it a cap?
Not a cowboy hat. No, but it's one of those like really hipster millennial hats. You know, where all the kids keep the brim really flat and it's a really tall. You know, I don't know how to explain it. It's not a dad hat. It's one of these, you know, millennial flat brimmed hats with a patch on it. You know what I mean?
You honestly think you pulled it off?
I think I pulled it off. The problem is like I have to cover up the hair, which is always a problem.
Yeah.
But secondly, I've got such a small head. My head doesn't hold a hat. Like I can't find a hat that makes any sense with the shape of this head.
I have the complete opposite.
Yeah.
Absolute complete opposite.
Yeah, you're trying to fit that big. You're trying to fit a hat on a C380. It's not working. By the way,
doesn't stay on. So
for those just joining us, welcome. For those who have been here forever, welcome back. The What Podcast, diving into music festivals and music culture and all of the behind the scenes industry talk that we can find. You are in for a treat today because an artist that has been on our list for a few years, just because we love her, has agreed to chat with us for a little bit. Grace Potter, coming out of her, I guess, her own isolation, has basically been on a whirlwind trying to, you know, see what her career and her life is outside of the Nocturnals and those albums and that relationship that she was in with her husband. She got out of that and her band, and now she's sort of isolated herself for a few years, and now she's sort of coming out of it with a new album. She's touring again. She's on festival lineups, and I just love her so much. And I love the way that she writes. I love her live show so much. This was one of those that was on our list really early when we started the show, Barry.
Yeah. A little spoiler, especially for you. I got to talk to her probably a month ago because she came close. She came to play the Caverns here, which is right near Manchester, as a matter of fact. And
that's right.
She's a great, great interview. She's a lot of fun, very open, very giving. And, you know, you've had those interviews where at the end you kind of apologize and say, I'm sorry, I kept you on the phone for so long. And the other person says, I could do this all day.
All day, yeah.
Those don't happen very often. But I hope I don't set her up and she's, you know.
Having a bad day.
Having a bad day. But she was great.
Who are these losers I'm talking
to? Can we get off? She's looking at her wrist the whole time, you know. No, she was terrific. And yes, she's great.
Yeah, very excited about this. So here we go. On the What Podcast, one of our favorite artists, at least appearing on the lineups this year, Grace Potter on the What Podcast next.
Great.
Grace, how are you? It's so lovely to see you.
I'm good. I'm just putting some dishes away. I'm going to stop planking around here in a second.
No, I love it. I love the real life look. Where are you? Are you at home? Or are you just
home? I'm in Vermont. Yeah, this is my view right now. I've got garden beds going, and I've been shoveling mulch all morning. So
yeah. So you're telling me that truck isn't always parked in the yard?
It does look pretty good. Maybe I should leave it there
like
from
it.
Now on.
Yeah.
All right.
I kind of like it.
Good, so, thank you.
Just a quick thing. Being in Vermont, at what point did you ever think about not living in Vermont?
Yeah. I mean, I lived, when I bought my house in Laurel Canyon, you know, I was there and that was where I lived. That was my home, diggity home, for like 7 years.
Yeah.
And we, you know, bounced back and forth, but I stayed in my, like, my little tiny barn house that I had renovated that used to be my dad's sign shop. And it's where, like, me and the Nocturnals used to rehearse there. And then all I did was, you know, add in a couple of beds and it became our house for a while. But, you know, that's not really like a home. That's not where you go to be home forever. And, I knew that Vermont was going to be a forever place, but I actually wasn't planning on moving back from California for another like 10 years. But with the pandemic, it just kind of felt like now's the time, you know?
Yeah, it has started asking. We all have started asking our questions really much earlier than we thought of where we want to plant our roots and stay.
Yeah.
You know, you've got, I can't tell you how many people I know live in New York through the pandemic have basically said, why am I here?
Yeah.
Oh, man. How many of those people?
Mainly, and it's, you know, because when you have the whole point of living in any city is that human contact and that cultural connection that you get from knowing that, like, you could just wander out into the street and meet a stranger that has a more interesting story than you. You know, any given day of the week, you could go and meet somebody amazing in this weird, wild world. And then that gets taken away. And then the rest of it's kind of like, oh, this is pretty inconvenient, you know, city life.
I'm paying $2,800 for 100 square feet.
That's right.
What?
That I have to be in all the time.
That's
why
right.
Why am I doing that?
Yeah. Why am I doing that? And, you know, the people that are fleeing some of these spots, I will say we moved to New Orleans and got 2 days after Mardi Gras last year and 2 weeks before a global pandemic sent us all home. So I got two solid weeks of living in New Orleans. Right. But it was weird in that the culture thing that you're talking about, that connection that you have with the city. You know, New Orleans had it and has it, you know, in spades. It's just billowing out of every building. But sometimes I would walk around New Orleans, I'm like, man, I feel like I'm in Charlotte.
Yeah.
You know, just even New Orleans was cut down and lost some of its magic through it.
It's
through
a quiet, it's, you know, it's, I like, the thing I like about New Orleans, though, is that, you know, even when there's a pandemic, and I'm wrong because I haven't been there during the pandemic, but I did read and also listen to a lot of podcasts and radio shows about the culture.
Was it the what podcast? It wasn't.
Maybe.
Was it? I know it.
Maybe. Well, there was basically just that a lot of barkeepers just kept their bars open for themselves and kept the music playing out the speakers of their windows, just so that you could feel that spirit of the music through town, even if there was no one gathering, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. The city, you know, it's not a meek place, and it's not for the meek, and it's not going to be silent. So, we did our best, and, you know, it took a little bit of time to get used to, but once they figured out the workaround, they always find a workaround.
Humans are incredibly adaptable, aren't we? But in New Orleans, it's just on another level. It's like, no one's going to get in the way of my party.
Not happening. Even if I got to do it in my yard.
I've
said this forever. I work at a radio station that obviously competes against WWOZ. But what WWOZ did with Jazz Fest last year and what they did again this year, they did a jazz festing in place. And it was... electric, and the entire city was listening to it all at once. We talked about this a few minutes ago, that communal experiences just don't happen in this country anymore.
Yeah.
And the fact that we were all doing it together felt real. You couldn't walk down my street without having somebody have a jazz fest in place party in their yard. That to me is remarkable. It's absolutely remarkable. And if there's one thing, look, I said this about Trump when he got elected, he's going to be good for us in that he's going to make us all have to realize what's important for us all. And totally. we're all gonna start reevaluating how we interact with this stuff. COVID's gonna do the same thing. We're all gonna be absolutely tied together for something. And that was the sort of the what happened last night. I went to the Black Pumas show, and for the first time in a year and 4 months, I was in a sold out show. And what Adrian and Eric said before the show is that when they hit that first note, they're gonna cry.
Yeah.
And it's going to be that sort of emotional release for them. Was totally. It for you when you finally got back on stage?
Absolutely. I mean, it was wild. Last year, I sort of agreed to be the guinea pig of the music industry at large, because we didn't know what was going to happen or how it was going to be. And I'm confident in my ability to perform live under pretty much any circumstance. And so I just felt like I would be a good candidate to try these things out. And I remember, you know, playing the first chord at a drive-in theater setup, and it was really emotional. I totally just, you know, I didn't break down and stop the song, but, you know, I just sort of wept gently through it.
that's actually kind of sweet, though.
Yeah,
it's kind of adorable.
I was going to ask Grace. You and I talked about a month ago before your cavern show.
Yeah, I remember. Yeah,
and you said you had spent the time to Brad's point. You had spent a lot of the time reconnecting with fans, the live streaming, and all of that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. So
yeah, maybe, and not even now, really reconnecting, but like connecting for the first time.
Right. So maybe now that you've been out a month, how is it feel? I mean, you just said that first note, but now that you've actually been playing live, for you're one of the pioneers, as you said, you've been the guinea pig. What's it like actually getting out and playing to a live audience now after what we've been through?
I mean, it depends on the show, because every show is totally different. There have been shows where I think the configuration of where everybody gets to set up is more conducive to the live performance. And there's others where it's more conducive to the human experience of being together again, because as I'm sure any ticket buyer knows, that, like, you know, as you're looking at the schedule of concerts coming up, you're buying tickets, but you're also planning potentially reunions with people that you haven't seen in over a year. You know, so music is such a cause for gathering back together, and like, oh my God, our favorite band is playing. Let's meet at X point and, you know, go see the show. So one of the things that happened that could never happen if it weren't for the pandemic is that there's a lot more talking from the audience because everybody's just seeing each other for the first time. And I think, as we as humans know, that when you haven't seen someone, there's a lot to catch up on, but also the excitement of a concert makes you yell a little louder and everything, you know, gets a little more energized. Uh-huh. So I was hearing like full on conversations from the audience, but I'm not a finicky performer. I'm never, ever going to shush the crowd. I just don't believe in shushing people. I think I got shushed a lot as a kid, so I have like a bit of a tick with being shushed. I would never shush anybody, but it was kind of like, and I've made this analogy a couple of times, but it's a good one. It's like being in a kitchen for Thanksgiving dinner where a bunch of relatives are reconnecting for the first time, and I'm just the turkey in the oven. So you know, like, it's like everybody's really excited for me.
You need to say, hey, do I need to give you guys a minute?
Yeah, no, totally.
Let me know when you're done.
I definitely enjoyed it because I really was then able to understand and see the connection of all these humans, because when everybody's gathered together, it's just this massive, you know, group of faces that kind of wash over you energetically and visually, that, you know, that's a very amazing feeling, but you can't really distinguish who came with who. And when you have the pods, you can. And then my mind kind of goes nuts and I start like making up stories about what's going on with each pod and who came from where and how complicated it was to make it all happen. And, you know, I really believe in that human experience, and I'm just honored that, you know, my music would be the thing to bring them together.
Well, you said something fascinating a second ago that you were the guinea pig and you didn't go into live.
Yeah, I said
I'm a
guinea pig and I'm a turkey. So I've got that. Right, yeah,
and that you don't go into live performances at all timid, but you don't really seem as though a kind of person that does anything very timid.
Not really. No. Yeah, maybe taking an eye exam.
Oh my God, that puff of air makes me cringe. I hate that puff of air.
I'm very timid in an eye exam.
Got it.
I have a question along those and totally shifting gears. Just because I want to ask, because I just watched it before. Was it more difficult? Totally shifting gears. More difficult to do the video for release or to do the song? Because it's so emotional.
That video is just the most intense piece of work I've ever been a part of. And thank you for the shift in gears, because I was just going over it yesterday. I reconnected with the director, Catherine Fordham, who, when you go through the story of my life and then you hear that song, I think one thing that she picked up on was that the song is more about one specific moment in my life, but the video is about the whole thing, like the big picture. And she didn't really know my story. She just, I think, adapted the storytelling that she found and connected with in that song, but also on the whole album Daylight. And I think she wrote it into the treatment for the video in such a thoughtful, profound way. And, you know, it took a long time to shoot the video. I had to train to be able to pull that boat across. Try pulling a boat full of water and seaweed across a sandy beach. Just give it a whirl. It's not super easy.
Well, that and to be able to cry on, I mean, there's a lot of acting going on in that.
I wasn't acting. That's the difference. Well, that moment was really spiritual. Also because there had been these fires, you know, the Woolsey fires came really, really close to my home and also took the home of a dear friend of mine. And we were right beneath where her house used to be. And, you know, having the fires blaze through, you know, in Southern California when they did, and watch it, the destruction, but also the recreation that it had caused, there was a pretty pivotal emotional moment as I'm dancing around this fire. And there's like fire marshals and police officers and like all kinds of people had to be there to make sure that everybody in Southern California knew that we had had a permit for the fire. Because fires are not really they're kind of frowned upon.
They're not a good idea.
They're not fun. That's for sure.
Not a good idea ever, but especially not in California.
But that made it even more emotional and special, I think, to be able to really, you know, have that.
Yeah, real quick, by acting, I didn't mean like pretending, because it was clear it was emotional. I just meant there's a lot of emotion and
absolutely. And very little makeup and hair, and you know, there was no wind machines, there's no fog machines, there's no magic tricks happening in that video. It really is happening as you're seeing it. And I think that was a profound choice as well, to just really let it be what it is and let my story speak for itself in many ways, just through the lyrics of the song, but also through the visuals.
And for those who don't know exactly your story, and I don't want to go through it too much. I mean, you do such a wonderful job everywhere you go when you talk about this sort of stuff. But when the Nocturnals ended and your marriage did as well, and you went into your own isolation of sorts, right?
Yeah, I did the lockdown before the lockdown, because I didn't know about that there was going to be a lockdown later. Yeah. I should have saved it.
You were well practiced. Let's just put it that way. You're well practiced.
Yeah, no, my relationship in my personal life as well as in my public life fell apart in front of everybody. And it was a really, really difficult thing. And it was also, it happened mainly because I wasn't able to separate my music career from my real life, because they were completely entangled. And I also wasn't able to separate the pain that I was feeling from music. So I kind of blamed music for all of the things that had gone wrong, and backed away from music in every possible way. And when I say that, I mean, like, I called my management and I was like, I'm done. I called Benny, my guitarist and my dear friend, and said, like, I cannot promise you when or if this is going to come back again. And that, and then there was 3 years that went by with very little thought or, you know, discussion as to what was going to happen next. And
it didn't worry you? It didn't scare you?
Oh, it scared the crap out of me. Of course. Yeah, no, I was really, I was devastated. And when you're broken like that, it's weird how time just kind of goes into a warp. But I had other things to be scared about too, like getting restraining orders and going to court. And, you know, there were other issues and dramatic things occurring in my life that took precedence over that. And in the midst of all that as well, having this incredible blossoming love with the love of my life. And now my husband, Eric Valentine, there was just no room, no space for me to share any of that with the outside world. It was very intense.
Well, you laid a good foundation because that's sort of where I was going to go. And I know this is going to be personal, but I think that, you know, you're able to understand what I'm saying. When you have to go through all of this again, and you have to write the album and go on tour with these songs and do interviews like this and then talk about this freely, you must be in a wonderful place, both mentally and with your current relationship, that can withstand these kinds of things just keep getting poked at and poked at and poked at.
Just to jump on to the point of my question about the video. I mean, that was so powerful to Brad's point. I mean,
to face it, though.
Yeah, you could have said, I think I don't want to.
People say things all the time to me, like my album has allowed them to assess things in their life that felt too uncomfortable to touch before that. And that's a really beautiful gift that I didn't mean to give anybody else. Mm. And nor did I really realize how much I needed it myself. But music is medicine. And for me, the process of unfolding my feelings from the past and my hopes and manifestations for the future came through music. And, you know, and then I put the album out, which it was totally terrifying. I had no idea when I wrote a lot of these songs that they were going to be heard by the public. I mean, my intention when I was writing this music was that it would help me to heal, because I've always found that when I write it into a song, it becomes more true. So if I'm really mad about something and I write a song about it, then I'm going to be angry about it forever. And then if I write a song about wanting to heal from something and I can put that into words and put it down, it does start to feel like part of my DNA changes as I reassess my relationship with a feeling or a memory.
It's so interesting to hear an artist talk about, I didn't write this for someone else or, mm-hmm. you know, that, and to have people come up and say, this song helped me so much. I interviewed Amanda Shires several years ago, and she said something like, people are constantly coming up and thanking her for saving Jason Isbell's life. And she's like, I don't get that. You know, I'm like, you know, I just did what I did because he's my husband. And I said, well, maybe it's because his music has meant so much to people that, you're helping him help them.
Yeah.
I think it kind of took her back. She said, I hadn't really thought of it that way. Which I find interesting because she's a songwriter. You know what I mean?
So, but a lot of times, you don't see it on the inside of it. It's not always easy. And it's also not always easy to give yourself credit for things that you didn't mean to do, you know? Right, so, I think again, through the process of opening up my story and as you said, like sort of continuing to poke at the beast of my life and the things that have challenged me. Mentally, I am in a good state. I am in a stable state where I feel comfortable knowing what those events led to, which is my present life. And I have a whole huge amount of gratitude every morning when I wake up feeling that. But, you know, I have my off days. And as I don't know if you guys know, but this month is Mental Health Awareness Month. And that's been a part of my journey as I've grown up with a sibling with pretty severe mental challenges. And mental health and therapy has been so stigmatized over time that Daylight for me as an album was my therapy, mm-hmm. but I didn't know it, you know? And then as it's come out and I've had these conversations, especially the tough ones that are kind of the conversations that are more stigmatizing because people are like, I'm feeling crazy. I'm feeling unstable. I'm feeling insecure in a way that I never did before. COVID has popped up a whole lot of feelings and fears and thoughts and regrets. And, you know, all of a sudden things are creeping into people's lives that haven't been that way before. And, you know, that's been part of my journey is trying to encourage people that, you know, it's okay to not be okay. And it's okay. Yeah.
And you're not alone.
Share that. And that you're not alone. And there's help there, you know?
And you said it, but the hardest thing that some people have to do is even finishing the sentence, I'm feeling blank.
Yeah.
And, you know, I will go to the moon and back about how much I love my therapist and how, you know, life changing she has been. Shout out Gail. Shout out Gail.
Yeah, Gail.
I mean, I really do
love
it. Bless
your heart, Gail.
And the best part of it was not just the fact that I could start answering the sentence or finishing the sentence, rather, I'm feeling blank.
Yeah.
But then I got to understand other people and how they might be feeling something, right?
Yeah.
It gave me this ability, almost this superhuman ability to see others. And if I'm going that deep inside of me to try and figure out what I'm thinking or feeling or going through, man, I can't imagine what that person's doing. And it just allows me to just become a better human being for everybody involved, not just myself.
Absolutely. And to take away the judgment. It's easy to, like, somebody cuts you off in traffic and you get really pissed and you just want to, they're like, what is their problem?
Right.
They're doing this to me. They're not doing anything to you. In fact, somebody in their life is bothering them and they're so busy thinking about that, that maybe they didn't even see you there. But I think that forgiveness and that compassion doesn't just happen. It's not a natural biological occurrence in humans. You know, we are fight or flight stress response type people. And that's just part of our makeup. So we have to really work to go deeper into some of those darker feelings and address them. But, you know, there's a way to do it and everybody is different. So cracking the egg open and letting it ooze slowly is not always the right thing for everybody. And I think in my case, writing Daylight was a long and very oozing egg for many years. It was just like gross yolk all over me.
along those lines, because it kind of adds to it, I think. One of the other things you said to me when we talked about a month ago, and I still think about it, we were talking about a lot of people have used this pandemic as a time to practice and get better and all that. And you said you hated practice and you don't do scales and all that.
I mean, I can do one right now.
So what was that? I mean, what was the, for someone who basically, as you said, turned it off for 3 years and who, you know, not a practicer, not a, you know, was it like riding a bike? I mean, what was the, how did that
work? I mean, there's definitely moments in my life as I get up on stage now without a band where I go, oh my God, I am ill prepared for this. I really should have run these songs before I got up here. And then I'm looking out and there's 1,000 faces waiting to hear something. So I am humbled by the solo performance. And I have actually been dipping back into the gift that I have of music and reassessing that and just sort of, turning it over and trying to understand what is it about it that I'm lucky to have and what is it about it that I'm going to continue to push forward on and try to improve. So that's happening right now.
But when you write that album and like you're sitting down at a piano right now. So when you have to go through all of these things and to use your analogy, yet another farm animal analogy, you crack the egg open, it all comes oozing out. Is it starting there on the piano? Is it starting with lyrics? Is it starting on an acoustic guitar? Where does it begin?
Sometimes it just depends on the day. And to be honest, when I'm feeling creative, it's all about the proximity of whatever the closest instrument is. There is no magic to it whatsoever. I can be musical even without an instrument. You know, I could beep the car horn and find a pitch that I think is somehow the right pitch for a song. And that will just set me off. And I'm lucky to down and I have a lot of focus when I'm in the midst of chasing down a song, because otherwise I'm quite ADD. But when I have a song that really feels like it's worth finishing, I can dive in.
So it's not a piecemeal thing for you. When you go in, you go all in, and you straight up wait until it's done.
Depending on how successful I think the song is, if it's not worth chasing, sometimes I'll tuck it away and say, maybe this is a piece of another song that's still waiting to be written, but I save everything. And I don't really categorize it because I don't write music according to genre. You know, I don't write a rock song and then write a sad ballad. I have a feeling and usually it'll come out in like 3 or 4 songs, and then I'll just sort of pick the best one.
Do you have somebody that you trust as like almost a song doctor? Do you have a doctor? Do you have somebody just send something like, hey, what do you think about this?
My husband, Eric Valentine, is the greatest producer I've ever met. I definitely, whether we got together or not romantically, I was going to make records with him for the rest of my life. But I knew when I met him that I felt comfortable even playing him my most embarrassing, crappy demos. You know, he is my consigliere of yeah. musical moments and musical choices. Yeah.
Nice. Was it when you started writing again? Was it a one moment, like all of a sudden I got to do this, or did it just ease its way on out? Or
it eased its way out. And again, I didn't even really realize, like, the song Release, I had written while I was moving out of my house in Laurel Canyon that I had lived in with my ex-husband. And it was my last day there before the new renters were going to be moving in. And I took a bath and I sat there, and I hadn't written music or sung a single note in a long time. But I was feeling just really like I was feeling contemplative and almost, it was almost a prayer. And as I was sitting there, I just started singing. And I apparently had my phone nearby enough to press record at some point. But that sat then in my inbox of my voice memos for another year and a half before I opened it back up again and considered.
So it really was a little bit of both. I mean, that moment came quickly, but then it said, okay, interesting.
Yeah, but that moment of reopening that memo, did mm-hmm. you remember what you had, or were you pretty scared to hit play?
I was terrified to hit play, especially because it was from that era of my life where I didn't know if I ever wanted to make music again. So I just assumed that everything, if there was something from that date, that it was probably pretty angry. And, you know, and the odds of it being a voice memo of, you know, some phone call with my lawyer, it was equal parts. Like, it could have been, you know, there was a lot of other things going on in my life, and I was recording a lot of things. None of them had titles. So a huge amount of this was kind of going back through the time capsule of my life and figuring out what was what. And yeah, there were a lot of voice memos that weren't songs at all. And they were really not pleasant to listen to, because it was like, you know, personal security officers and just crazy, dramatic, unnecessary things that I wanted to be able to tuck away and, well, actually delete forever. But I'm really glad I didn't hit delete on that one before listening to it.
Yeah, it does make me feel a tad panicky just thinking about it.
Yeah, no kidding. Could have been anything. But to be clear, so this entire tour that you're doing is just you, right?
Yeah, this is a solo collective of shows, although I've had moments where, okay, I've got 10% juice on my phone. That's exciting.
Me too.
Let's wrap this up. No, this is a solo tour, but there were a couple shows on this last bit of it, on the last leg, down in Florida, where I just looked at the stage and looked at the ticket sales of how many people were coming and how big the venue felt, and was like, I think I'm going to need some help here. So we do travel with a drum kit and a bass amp, so that in case I feel like enlisting my husband and my front of house sound guy, who are my only crew. That's all it is.
Okay.
It's a really small, this is a family band in every sense of the word.
Are you hooking up the lights too, Grace? Jesus.
No. Yeah, I actually do. I'm so check this out. This is one of my light rigs. I found it on the internet, and I thought, well, that thing looks really cool. And it's these tiny little go-go lights that illuminate different parts of you. One of them's a black light, one of them makes it look like there's a sunset, one of them makes it look kind of like iridescent and psychedelic. So yes, I'm actually doing the lighting.
Can it make me a good dancer? Can it make me
make my butt look big?
I have been dancing. There is dancing at these shows. That's all really right. Been a fun thing to be a solo performer and figure out what is it that I can play that will make it still feel like a dance party. And it's totally possible. I mean, Sister Rosetta Tharp is my hero, and she made me dance from the second I heard her play. So that's what I'm going for.
Are we breaking news that there might be twerking on Grace Potter's tour? Could it be possible?
Never, ever, anything is possible.
The other thing you said, the last thing that you said when we talked before, was that this tour, what you were looking forward to is the spontaneity.
Spontaneity. Has happened. I mean, that has been the prevailing sensation of this tour, has been the fact that I am not coming up on stage with a plan. And there's a reason why. And it's because the audience matters so much to me. And especially having this year to connect with my fans in a way that has been really profound, especially when it comes to what songs people want to hear. You know, I can't write a set list better than the crowd. The crowd knows my songs. And I mean, you won't believe some of the requests that have come in where it was just like this one-off time that I played a song when the power went out at a bar in New Jersey. Mm-hmm. And they were there when I played that version of Dead Flowers, the Graham Parsons way. Like, what? You know? Nice. And that's the kind of conversations that are being had with me in the audience. And, you know, if I had a band there, I certainly might do a little bit of conversing with the crowd. But I think it really opens up the possibility for me to play exactly what people want to hear. Yeah. And it's never the same thing twice. And it's just been so cool.
Wasn't the show at the Cavern, I know it was well over 2 hours. Was it almost three?
I tipped the scale at 2.5 hours on one of the nights. And then the next night I had to, you know, I didn't want to play any less time. So I just tried to match it so I could give people an equal experience, you know?
Well, you've given us an amazing experience. I can't tell you how much I love you. You've been one of my Bonnaroo darlings for years. So I'm just so happy that things are feeling so right in life for you. I feel like the music is exploding from you. And I think that I'm not going to speak for everybody, but I'm glad to have you back. I'm glad to have you back. And thank you so much. And thanks for being on the show. This is a big treat. You were one of our top of the list when we started the show 3 years ago. So I'm very excited to have you join us. Thanks so much, dear.
Thank you.
Thank you. It was good talking to you guys. Thanks so much.
You too. Bye, Grace.
Take care.
Yeah. Grace Potter on the What Podcast, an absolute stunner. She is a stunner in every aspect of life. I just love everything about her. The other thing I love, Barry, is that we keep putting people on this show that I just enjoy as human beings.
Thank you. That's exactly right. And I think I mentioned that before we started talking is as I found out throughout this, they're just people. Yeah. You get to see a little bit more of it. They're very talented people. I mean, she can write a song with her car horn, apparently.
Yeah. Well, I almost brought this up, but remember LCD Sound System on their last album? James Murphy wrote an album, wrote a song based on the fan that was oscillating above his head. He sampled that sound and it became "Hey Baby."
Well,
baby.
I'll give you one more. The Funky Drummer, the beat that we all know from James Brown. Clyde Stubblefield based that on a factory near his house here in Chattanooga and a train.
Really? I didn't know that.
Yep. Yeah. He
Say that again. Go through that one more time, just Clyde in case I missed it.
Clyde Stubblefield, the Funky Drummer, grew up here. Uh-huh. And if you hear it, you could hear the ch-ch-ch-ch, which he got from a train, but there was a factory that had like a boom, 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 irregular, and he combined the two and he came up with the Funky Drummer beat.
No kidding. I did not know that Chattanooga connection. Look at the Barry Quarter coming in clutch. That's going to be, you're writing an article about that, aren't you?
I have.
Okay. I know.
It's big.
Is it?
It's amazing. Yeah.
Well, but it's true. Before we get too much further, the music that you hear in between segments, that's our buddy Nick. He has got a band that is absolutely incredible. Midist, MIDIST. They're going to be part of the What Podcast from here on out, creating these amazing soundscapes that I hope that you go support on Bandcamp, on Spotify, Apple Music. Search Midist, MIDIST. I think of it a lot like study beats. You know, it's just those wonderful, you know, atmospheric beats that are, you know, in you all the time, that you can find a situation that you're in. You can find a Midist, you know, beat for it. I absolutely in love with it. And he's a fellow campmate.
I was going to say, might be the most talented one of us. He's certainly the most quietly talented. He's the one that came up with the graphics.
If you've seen
Nut Butter heads and the marquee, that was Nick.
Yep, it's all Nick Turner and Midist, MIDIST, as well as our friends Repeat with the What Podcast theme song. I know we keep saying this each and every week, but next week we're starting How to Make a Hit. It's a two-parter. It starts with an A&R guy, Mike Daly from Hollywood Records. And then the second part, very exciting, will be somebody that is very important in my life because he's my boss. How to Make a Hit, two-parter, starts next week. I know we keep putting it off, but I really want to get this Grace Potter interview out there because I think that she's got something so important to say, especially in the time frame that she has to say it with, you know, the Mental Health Awareness Month now behind us. So there you go. Thanks for joining the What Podcast, which bands this year that matter, the whatpodcast.com. Please rate, review the show on your Apple Podcast or wherever you get your podcast from. It would really help us. On the Consequence Podcast Network, it's Barry Quarter, Lord Taco, and Brad Steiner. We'll talk to you next week. Love you. Bye. You're always trying to do your best. Don't worry about what happens next. Cause it never ends. We just begun. We crash into the same time. So
Consequence Podcast Network.